From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation with the editor-in-chief of the Consortium News website, Joe Loria. At the front page of Consortium News this week, John McCain, The View from the Middle East, an online vigil in defense of Julian Assange, the unlikely force behind U.S. prison reform, the Trump administration's spoiler foreign policy, VIPs tell media, support for Brennan is not unanimous, and back in the great game, the revenge of Eurasian land powers. Okay, Joe, so we're going to do another perusal of the front page of consortiumnews.com. Let you take us on a tour.
Well, thank you, Don. It's always a good laugh and also a serious look.
Yeah.
At what we're reporting, I just want to say also that we've begun podcasts on Libsyn, and these broadcasts that we do will be included on those podcasts so people can go back and listen to them there. We'll soon be on iTunes and Spotify, et cetera, et cetera.
Beautiful.
So the story we have up top right now is by Asad Abdul Khalil, known better to most people as the Angry Arab. He runs the Arab Angry blog, which I recommend to everyone.
Yep.
If you really want to go deep into the Middle East, maybe too deep for a lot of Westerners, but he's a Lebanese professor out in California, where I am right now, speaking to you from Oakland. Hmm. So this is the last piece.
This isn't the first piece about McCain either. We had Max
Blumenthal, which was an excellent piece that got over 54,000 page views, probably a record for Consortium News. That was an excellent obit that Max Blumenthal wrote. This one focuses only on McCain's activism in the Middle East. So from a Middle East perspective, how is McCain seen? And Assad begins his piece with a very interesting little anecdote here. You've all heard how McCain was praised for the answer he gave to a woman during the campaign when she was complaining about Obama being an Arab, and McCain said, "No, ma'am, he's not an Arab. He's a decent family man."
Right.
And apparently that was played over and over again. I did not watch not one second of McCain festivities, except out of the corner of my eye in a restaurant. I think I might have mentioned on our last show, but I did not watch it. But I believe Assad when he tells me that they mentioned that over and over again. Yes, he's not an Arab. He's a decent family man. In other words, Arabs cannot be decent family men, but that's not the way it was seen here. But Assad is pointing out that's the way Arabs are, clearly. So Mr. McCain or Senator McCain was clearly no friend of Arabs and Muslims, except those who could help extend his agenda and America's agenda in the Middle East, such as bloody dictators and would-be regime changers like Ahmed Chalabi in Iraq, and jihadist extremists in Syria, would-be overthrowers of the Syrian government in Damascus. So clearly, he was driven by politics, by geopolitics. He was, in my opinion, and as Assad ends the piece, a face of American empire without any question. This is why I think he's given the attention he's gotten right now, the deification that he's gone through, not because of who John McCain was, but because of who he represented, what he represented, what he symbolized, which is America's power in the world and its continuing interest in maintaining and extending that power and containing the only threats really to that power, which are China and Russia combining together, and that Eurasia being there again of the world in terms of controlling the world, which could segue us into the piece by Pepe Escobar, unless you have some questions about McCain, Don.
No, I'm all McCained out.
You're McCained out as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say one other thing. Excuse me, if readers go to that, to our piece, which has been published yesterday, John McCain, The View from the Middle East, the photographs that I chose three photographs for this article. There are no humans in them except a bunch of refugees leaving the bombed out a mosque in Mosul. The second picture is the destruction of Italian tanks that belonged to the Gaddafi government during the March 2011 NATO intervention. And the last one is a scene of destruction in homes. So I just showed the results of John McCain's efforts in the Middle East, just three pictures of destroyed places
Iraq,
that he left,
Libya,
he
Syria.
Left behind. This is the legacy of John McCain.
That's right. Absolutely. That,
no know, more
dead people also in each of these places. I mean, these you're showing ruins, things that were blown up. And, of course, there were people that were murdered when this happened also all over the place. Still happening, too.
Of course. And still, not wholly, but he was a major. I mean, he made this effort to go overseas and to meet with these guys and drum up support. It was almost like his own foreign policy. You talk about the Logan Act. Was he authorized to do all of this stuff? Probably. But McCain, no pictures of humans, no pictures of George W. Bush giving a cough drop to Michelle Obama on my story.
Right.
Only destruction in the Middle East.
It's reality.
Next story we had was, let's see, what is the next story, Don?
Next story on in terms of sequence, it's the Julian Assange-a-thon over the weekend.
Correct. Yes, I took part in an 11-hour, so did Don DeBar, by the way, 11-hour marathon, actually shorter than the 50-hour one last week. This is a monthly event that's held online, organized by Susie Dawson, incredibly talented and tireless activist.
Yeah, amazing.
She needed some breather because she's also working to organize the on-the-ground street demonstrations, which took place in various places around the world. The following day, Sunday, this broadcast was Saturday. Of course, I was to take it over completely, but Susie still did most of the work, I have to say.
Right.
Although maybe I relieved her a little bit, was my first time. So we're going to try to next time give her even less time involved. But there were a couple of just technical hiccups. I think I'm going to have to anchor those transitions. What we did was have each person get interviewed for a half hour, and then they interviewed the next person. And I also, at the end, was able to engineer Dan Ellsberg to come on the line, and I did a straight interview with him for 35 minutes, which the whole thing is right now on the site, the whole 11 hours, but I've just gotten this morning the edited version of just my interview with Dan Ellsberg, and I'm going to post that this afternoon, hopefully, or tomorrow. And that is really worth watching because Dan was terrific. He's 88 years old, and he's speaking as sharply as he ever has.
Yes, he is.
And very strongly in defense, of course, of Julian Assange, of Chelsea Manning. He complained about her not getting the visa to Australia. It's really worth watching this interview with Dan. He does almost all the talking, so you don't have to listen to me. It's Dan Ellsberg, and I really highly recommend that. Look for that later in the day today as the whole 11 hours is still up there.
Right. And again, that's at consortiumnews.com.
Correct. What else are we talking about today, Don?
Let's see. We've got Kiriakou, John Kiriakou's piece about the unlikely force behind U.S. prison reform.
Correct. That's an interesting piece. John is writing a column for us now, and we're happy about that. John is looking at something that I wasn't aware of, frankly, which is the role of the Christian right in prison reform. It might be the only right thing that the Christian right does, as far as I could tell. They want to reduce some of the absolute abuses that take place in our system in terms of the vast numbers of people in prison, more than anywhere else, of course, in the world. And he points to Chuck Colson, who was a hatchet man for Nixon during the Watergate days, becoming, born again while he was in prison. And he came out, of course, he was in prison. I guess it's like that story of the conservative, the liberal who gets mugged or something.
Right.
So he's a conservative who goes to jail and becomes a liberal when it comes to prison issues.
Yep.
Just the opposite. So he was in jail. He didn't like it. So he wanted to. He's made this a life issue of him. This prison fellowship that he started. So, but it now extends to the Trump administration, which has got the Christian right support, which is clearly Republican, even though the Christian right being behind that and somehow supporting Trump, even though he's not a very holy man by his behavior, it seems like. But the Christian right and the presidency are combining, and part of the reason is because of Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, whose father spent time in jail for financial crimes back in 2004. He spent 24 months. I think he got out in 14 months. He was sentenced to 24 months. So Jared Kushner has an interest in prison reform because his dad was in jail. So this is the way it seems to go. And they are working on a bill, and Trump supports it, that would lower lifetime mandatory sentences on drug issues to only 25 years, reduce 20-year mandatory minimum sentences for offenders up to 15 years. The whole list of the things that are up there are on this on our side in the story. The point being that it's the Christian right and the Republicans who are pushing more for prison reform right now than liberals, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, I saw a statistic go by last week, and I didn't have a chance to fact check it, but even if it was within two orders of magnitude, it was quite impressive that something like 50 new felonies are created every year under the federal code. In other words, 50 things that were not a felony before are this year a felony as a result of, you know, the hard work of our friends and neighbors in the Congress. And, you know, the implications of that, of course, are obvious. And it certainly does help to illuminate the pie charts and the slopes of the curves that demonstrate prison populations over the last 20, 30 years, for example.
You read that in the first paragraph of John Kiriakou's story that we're discussing. He points out that Congress creates 50 new crimes every year. He says that's 500 things that were legal a decade ago that are now felonies.
Right.
No wonder the prisons are full, John says.
Yeah, right, yep.
It's an extraordinary thing. I wasn't aware of that. I had no idea. So that's John's story on Consortium News, which tells you a different angle. We were mostly focused on foreign policy. I'm glad to have a domestic story come up.
Yep. Well, let's go to foreign policy now, because the next story is the Trump administration's spoiler foreign policy, and that's Patrick Lawrence's article.
That's correct. Patrick looks at Trump's foreign policy. He asks whether there is such a thing as a Trump foreign policy, because one can't really tell who's running it, whether it's Trump, whether it's Minders, who among his Minders, what's going on behind the scenes. We only see the results of this. He says one thing, another thing happens. You remember, I think it was in Ohio some months ago, he announced that we're pulling out of Syria. Everybody got excited.
Right.
The United States is still in Syria. The special forces, the 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000, whatever they are, still there in oil areas in eastern Syria. What's the point of Trump formulating what seems like rational policy once in a while, and then it's not implemented? What's going on? We can't tell. That probably won't be. Maybe Bob Woodward is coming out with an inside account of what's going on in the White House. We might, although I don't trust him necessarily. I usually give the establishment point of view all the time. However, there might be nuggets in there about what goes on behind the scenes in terms of who makes the actual decisions or who makes what people are involved in different decisions, et cetera. So the point, the result is, however, again, this points to Pepe's article, which we're going to probably talk about less, about geopolitics, is that the U.S. is behind the eight ball. It is not doing very well in terms of it's trying to control Eurasia, China, and Russia. Of course, it's still surrounding both, and it is still a menace to both those. And certainly it has not lost this geostrategic battle, but it is losing it, and losing it on the periphery, like in Syria. This is a loss. Libya was a disaster. Iraq, a disaster. So where the United States has been acting recently has really led to mostly defeats. And what is this add up to in Patrick Lawrence's estimation is that the U.S. has now been reduced not to the major global power running things, but as a spoiler. It's trying to stop Russia and China from consolidating their alliance, which was prompted very much by the Obama administration and their sanctions against Russia. They drew China and Russia even closer together on economic, most economic and military even alliances. So the U.S. is reduced to a spoiler. So that would maybe explain why Syrian special forces, the U.S. special forces, remain in Syria to just muddy up things, screw things up, slow things down. It's not in the driver's seat anymore, but it's in the passenger seat telling the driver to make a wrong turn.
Right.
This is what the U.S. foreign policy is what Patrick is saying.
Yeah, and in addition to that, you have the navigator, what they call, the Google Maps thing, whatever, screaming at you to take a different turn while the passenger is telling you to make this turn. The guy in the back seat is telling you, no, it's that, go that way. Because we're looking at Nikki Haley saying one thing. Pump, all these various people. You got the Secretary of State, and you've got Bolton, and all these other characters. Each one has a characterization of what a particular policy is. And then when Trump's finally heard from, very often, none of them had it right.
Recalculating Isn't that what the GPS says right. when you've made a wrong turn? That's
right. Recalculating.
That could have been the title of this piece, just recalculating, because that's what American foreign policy seems to be right now. It is a very interesting and good read from Patrick Lawrence. He's also writing a regular column for us right now. So we're getting down to some good writers here. Pepe Escobar, Max Blumenthal, John Kiriakou, Patrick Lawrence, all writing regularly for ConsortiumNews.com. Really, for the first time, all of them are new writers for Consortium. And take it away, Don. What's next?
Some good stuff. I think we were going to – let's see. Well, the next thing on the page is the VIPs, but I think we're going to go to Pepe, right? We had Pepe.
Yeah, the VIP was interesting because it's about John Brennan's security clearance being lifted. That happened a couple of weeks ago. But the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, begun by Bill Binney, former NSA technical director, and Ray McGovern, former CIA officer, used to brief George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan in the morning CIA briefings, was started about 15 years ago, just before the invasion of Iraq, pointing out that this was a mistake and that there was no intelligence proving WMD, and they were proven right, of course, and they've been proven right many, many times after. This is, I think, the first one in 15 years that is not addressed to the president, but is addressed in the vein of Ray's briefings to the president. This one is addressed to the media.
Right.
And it's saying essentially that this, and this was immediately apparent to me, and I'm sure lots of people, when they used this line that lifting John Brennan's security clearance was a violation of his First Amendment rights. Well, how could that possibly be? Nobody's telling him he can't talk.
Right.
They're saying he doesn't have access to classified information anymore, and then talk.
Right.
So maybe the networks don't want him anymore because he won't have that access. I don't know if that's true, but if it is, that's not. That's the decision of the private networks, and they're allowed to suppress.
Right.
That's what they're telling us, right?
So by the way,
they're telling us that Facebook and Google can censor us because they're private companies at the behest of the government, who browbeat them in open testimony in Congress to do so. So now if Brennan is going to lose his gig on MSNBC because that's tough turkey, you know?
Well, what we're talking about is classified information. And so what they're saying is, in essence, what we've been doing is paying Brennan for access to classified information. I'm not expert in the federal code, but that sounds like a felony or several felonies.
Well, I don't know whether he's reviewed. I don't watch him on MSNBC or any of these former intelligence people, so I don't know what he's actually saying. I haven't heard. I usually read about it when they say something of significance, but I think the issue is that he can't leak anymore to the New York Times and the Washington Post. And from the moment Trump got in, we started getting these unbelievable leaks that you wouldn't find out usually till 20 years later. What happened in a meeting between Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, and Trump in the Oval Office a couple of weeks after Trump was inaugurated? That was the next day in the New York Times, everything that was said. So somebody in that room, you know, has clearance, clearly, and went down the chain either directly or indirectly, got to people probably like Brennan and Clapper, et cetera, who became these unnamed sources for the New York Times, and that's what we got. The whole Russiagate story has been fed almost all on these unnamed sources, at least until these Mueller indictments, which have no evidence. It's just they're just accusations, and they could be based a lot on these intelligence statements that could be made up. We don't know because they're unnamed, but the access that Clapper and that Brennan had to this could allow them to leak it to the New York Times and the Washington Post, which I think happened somehow in that, let's just example that Lavrov meeting. So that will cease. I think that is what Trump's motivation was, and he probably should have done it earlier, but it is not a restriction of Brennan's freedom of speech.
Right.
It's just extraordinary that they would even try to think that. So Brennan, so this Vips memo was pointedly addressed to the media and also said, hey, not everybody in the intelligence community, you know, love John Brennan, and it goes on to describe his various misdeeds, even crimes, where he lied to Congress about not spying on the Senate during the torture memo investigation, about how when he was station chief in Riyadh that he immediately blamed Hezbollah for the Khobar Towers bombings, even though there was never any evidence for that. It was Al-Qaeda, which is Sunni, which is linked to Saudi Arabia, of course.
Right.
So You know, this amendment was, if you want another rundown of everything evil about John Brennan and why he should never have kept his security clearance. And don't forget, this is signed by about a dozen or more people who all had security clearances in their careers, so they know what it is. And the responsibility, they point out, is a restriction on their freedom of speech. And they've agreed to that. They're going to learn something they can't talk about, even in some cases to their own spouses, and including for the rest of their lives. So John Brennan doesn't deserve that. Clearance is what these professionals, intelligence, former intelligence officials are saying, and it's a very powerful memo.
I mean, Senator Mark Udall, in December of 2014, so it's not ancient history, people that are involved in this now should remember it, talks about when, you know, Brennan's time at the CIA, that they lied to its overseers and the public, meaning Congress and the public, destroyed and tried to hold back evidence, spied on the Senate, made false charges against Senate staff, and lied about torture and the results of torture. That's, you know,
for starters. For starters.
Yeah, yeah. That's one line in a long resume of, you know, kindred actions. So.
Yeah, yeah. No reason to shed any tears over Brennan losing a security clearance.
Right.
That's coming from a... definitely a non-Trump supporter, but I'm telling you that Brennan is bad news. This memo makes it clear why.
All right, so we can go now to Pepe. I know this is a kind of a coup getting him to sign up on consortiumnews.com.
Very thrilled to have Pepe Escobar, who I've been reading for years, as many of your listeners have. I really like Pepe. I think he's great on TV. He's very funny, and he's very incisive, and he's brilliant usually on geopolitical issues, which he is in his premier piece for Consortium News. It's called Back in the Great Game, The Revenge of Eurasian Land Powers. And here's Pepe again and coining some great lines here, which one of them is, it's now China's new Silk Roads versus America's our way or the highway. I mean, that really...
That's perfect.
Encapsulates the whole thing
there.
That's the whole story, because it's about China and Russia integrating economically to the point where they are creating an integrated economic unit, and they want to bring Western Europe into that. That is the ultimate nightmare of Kissinger and Brzezinski, as Pepe points out, to keep Europe out of the Eurasian integration, which for the Europeans' interests would be much greater than having the status quo, which is sanctions against Russia, which are particularly hurting German business. They've never been for it. The German businessmen were against it from the start. Merkel is torn between them, German interests, and what America's telling her to do. NATO, what is NATO telling, which is the U.S. telling her to do. So if China, if there were ever a Berlin, Moscow, Beijing axis, that would be cause heart attacks up and down to Pennsylvania Avenue and all around the Beltway.
Right.
And this is what Pepe is talking about. Of course, he goes into his theories about Mackinder and Spykman, and these are the root of the geostrategic strategy, which is to contain and encircle Eurasia, which includes, of course, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and all of Asia. From Japan to from Tokyo to Lisbon, or from Vladivostok to Madrid, we've got a long, that is the major landmass on Earth.
Right.
And the U.S. is using sea power to try to control it. And Pepe is arguing about how the importance of land troops as well in this, in the creation of this Silk Road, which it's going to take years and years to build. But China is building while the United States is destroying. Another great line. Line of Pepe Escobar's. Yes, China, does China get advantages from this? No doubt about that. Most of them being that they send Chinese workers to Africa to work on these infrastructure projects and don't hire perhaps as many Africans as they should. But they're leaving behind infrastructure in Africa. They are ultimately going to improve the economies of all these countries in Africa and Latin America. And they are, you might call it economic colonialism. It is not invading with bombs and troops like the United States is still doing. It's so 20th century done. And to invade Iraq with hundreds to thousands of troops and occupy a country. And then to have John Kerry say after the annexation of Crimea, bloodless annexation of Korea following a referendum, countries don't invade other countries in the 21st century.
Yeah, right.
When he voted for the invasion of Iraq, after he voted against it or for it or whatever he did, he was in favor of that invasion, yeah. And he did your audacity. I just pulled that out as an example. The audacity of American thinking to say that Russia and China are the imperialists here,
right?
When they are pursuing a model, multilateral model that the world needs in order to survive, and the U.S. doing everything to undermine it. Why? Because its supremacy at the end of World War II, when it was left with a world empire, a destroyed world, except for the U.S., which had rebuilt itself through its war industry, stood across the whole world in total control. It had ships everywhere and bases. It was not even by design necessarily, but they were left with a world empire. They've been trying to maintain that ever since, using everybody. And their brother who opposes the U.S. is Hitler, still using World War II terminology. And now here's Russia and China trying to integrate peacefully with the world. The U.S. cannot have it. So this is a great, great piece by Pepe in explaining that dynamic.
And if anyone thinks that he's being, he's exaggerating or whatever, it's an interesting piece of testimony that was given to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee 2 weeks ago, August 21st. 2018, by Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, A. West Mitchell. And I'm just going to pull these two sentences out of the opening paragraphs. The first is, Russia and China are serious competitors that are building up the material and ideological wherewithal to contest U.S. primacy and leadership in the 21st century. It says here that it continues to be the foremost national security interest of the United States to prevent the domination of the Eurasian landmass by hostile powers. In other words, it's our policy to prevent Russia and China from dominating the land that they're on.
Exactly. Hostile powers on their own land.
Right.
So they're hostile to us in their own country. Isn't right. that amazing?
How dare they?
Just the way, come on. You know, the implication, and that's a perfect quote, it goes exactly to the heart of Pepe's theory, but the implication there is, again, that the U.S. has the rights to this landmass, and it does it, and that China and Russia are hostile because they are trying to take over the world. Look at the bases that they have around the world. China has one overseas military base in Eritrea, I believe, or in Djibouti. I think it's in Djibouti. One overseas military base. And so are they trying to take over the world? Russia has maybe about eight, and most of those are in the former Soviet countries in Central Asia that they were allowed to keep there. So they didn't actually extend it. They just didn't leave. These are the two powers that are trying to dominate the world. They are couching. This is classic projection, Don, right. Where the U.S. imperialism is projected onto the people who are trying to block American imperialism, that they're the imperialists, not us. We're spreading democracy, which brings us back to John McCain and Assad Gabriel Khalil's piece, where he talks about all this nonsense that of McCain being a democracy spreader, where the head of Human Rights Watch apparently in Washington called him that, when of course he was just using that language like any conquistador does. We're coming to bring freedom, and we're going to kill you if you stand in our way. This is his idea of freedom. Right. So this is the world we're living in right now, and the pieces we have up there will help readers understand it just a little bit better, and I appreciate you having me on to talk about that.
And we're glad to have you. I guess we'll close with Pepe's closing. You know, he talks about the horizon for the Belt and Road Initiative is 2039, and that it's really starting to get installed next year. So we're talking about a 20-year period that's just about to begin. It's been 5 years since it was announced by Xi Jinping, and it took that long for there to be any kind of a response from the U.S. And this is taking place, as you mentioned, China's offering an alternative within the context, which we've discussed here a number of times, where China is offering the world places like Africa, Latin America, win-win as a way of engagement. In other words, things that will benefit both sides because they see having enriching their partners as a way of enriching themselves. More, if you're rich enough to buy more stuff from me, you'll buy more stuff from me. The U.S. model being, give me your stuff. Oh, by the way, carry it over to my boat and leaving nothing behind that. And so hopefully we're seeing the dawn of a new day that's springing. And we're going to see you again next week and see what you got popping on page one of consortiumnews.com.
Well, thank you very much, Don.
Joe,
I hope that new day comes. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.